This week on Making Contact.
Ending complicity in Israel's violations of international law and human rights is not heroic. It's a basic moral obligation.
Inspired by the campaign to end South African apartheid, Palestinians are leading an international campaign to put economic and political pressure on Israel. Best known by its acronym BDS, stands for Boycotting Israeli Products, Divesting from Israeli Companies, and Pushing for International Sanctions on Israel.
As we've seen in other cases of such intensive oppression, it takes not just internal resistance and the will to resist, it takes international solidarity.
On this edition, Palestinian activist Omar Barghouti talks about the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign and how it's part of a wider effort to end the colonization of Palestinian lands and mines. I'm George Lavender and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas and important information.
Internalizing inferiority and accepting inequality and injustice as fate is the ultimate triumph of the oppressor. Therefore, decolonizing the mind becomes the most burning imperative for the oppressed in order to see the light.
That's Omar Barghouti, a Palestinian human rights activist speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in February 2013. Barghouti is a founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel and the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Campaign. He's also the author of BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. He began his talk by explaining what he saw as the dehumanization of Palestinians by Israel.
Now, the oppressor colonizes the mind as well as the land. And the former is much more dangerous than the latter in very different ways. I'll just reflect on some of the experiences Palestinians have had with Israeli settler colonialism and occupation. In December 1987, in the first popular uprising, soon after it started, actually in February 1988, Israel shut down all 6 Palestinian universities and 13 colleges. Soon after, they shut down all 1,194 schools in the West Bank, and then all Palestinian kindergartens. Education became illegitimate, according to Israeli military rules. In fact, classes went underground, and any student held with a book in her hand was held accountable and arrested, and the book confiscated. Education became illegal in Palestine during the First Intifada. A Jerusalem Post article on 19 April 1989, in fact, reported that the Israeli police, without any sense of irony, they reported, the Israeli police had, quote, uncovered a network of illegal classes held by West Bank universities at private high schools in East Jerusalem. Scary. But this is not a new phenomenon. The attempt by Israel to colonize Palestinian minds goes as far back as 1948, during the Nakba, the initial campaign of ethnic cleansing of the majority of the indigenous Palestinians. Thanks to a Jewish Israeli graduate student who did his PhD on Israel's treatment of Palestinian books, we now know Zionist militias and then the State of Israel systematically pillaged and destroyed tens of thousands of Palestinian books from private homes, from libraries, from schools, from everywhere. Destroyed them systematically. And this researcher said that Israel destroyed the Palestinian books in the framework of its plan to, quote, Judaize the country and cut off its Arab residents from their nation and culture. Sounds familiar in this country. This was a cultural massacre, he says, undertaken in a manner that was worse than European colonialism, which safeguarded the items it stole in libraries and museums. But we know that you cannot light a fire in a constrained area without the fire catching on to you. You get burnt as well. The oppressor is also somehow destroying something within when they try to dehumanize the other and destroy them. And this is reflected in testimonies by Israeli soldiers who fought in the first Israeli attack on Gaza 2008-2009. Some of the testimonies were extremely disturbing. A soldier narrated how a well reported incident of intentionally shooting and killing an elderly Palestinian woman took place. He says, a company commander saw someone coming on some road, an old woman, he says. She was walking along pretty far away, but close enough so you could take her out. The commander sent people up to the roof to take her out, and so they did. So the journalist asks the soldier, why did they shoot her despite knowing that she's an elderly woman that posed absolutely no threat? And the soldier replies, that's what is so nice, supposedly, about Gaza. You see a person on a road, walking along a path. He doesn't have to be with a weapon. You don't have to identify him with anything, and you can just shoot him. This was further reflected in T-shirt designs. Israeli army platoons compete who can produce the most repulsive T-shirt designs. And some of these designs were truly scary. For example, one had a crosshairs on a pregnant woman's belly, a Palestinian pregnant woman's belly, with this bullseye superimposed on her belly, with the slogan in English, one shot, two kills. Israeli sociologist Orna Sasson Levy reflected on this, saying that this phenomenon is a part of a radicalization process the entire country is undergoing, and the soldiers are at its forefront. There's a perception, she says, that the Palestinian is not a person, a human being entitled to basic rights, and therefore anything may be done to him. And I'll go over some titles and excerpts from the Israeli media on this dehumanization process, which I think is very important to put BDS in context. Haaretz, on July 5th, 2006, reported widespread illegal experiment conducted at Meir Hospital. 60 women were subjected to medical experimentation without their approval, predominantly Palestinian women. And a leading rabbi encouraged IDF soldiers to use Palestinian human shields, including children, as human shields. And in Petah Tikva, a city near Tel Aviv, the authorities, local authority, the municipality, announced that it was establishing a special team of youth counselors and psychologists whose job it will be to identify young Jewish women who are dating Arab men and rescue them. One of the few polls on the subject in 2007 found that more than half of Israeli Jews believed intermarriage with Arabs should be equated with, quote, national treason. Israel's former Shin Bet chief, Yuval Diskin, had this to say. He said, over the past 10 to 15 years, Israel has become more and more racist. All of the studies point to this. This is racism towards Arabs and towards foreigners, and we're also become a more belligerent society. This is the head of Shabak speaking. Going to the issue of rights and fighting against this escalating prevalence of racism, racial hatred, ethnic cleansing, siege of Gaza, and all kinds of policies by the oppressor, Palestinians insist on equal rights as all humans. Archbishop Desmond Tutu once said, I'm not interested in picking up crumbs of compassion thrown from the table of someone who considers himself my master. I want the full menu of rights. And exactly the same way, Palestinians, through the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, are seeking our full menu of rights. What do we mean by that? BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, is a call that was issued by a great majority of Palestinian civil society in 2005. It specifically called for three basic rights of the Palestinian people, three UN-respected rights: ending the occupation of 1967 with the colonies and the wall and so on, ending the system of racial discrimination in Israel, which conforms to the UN definition of apartheid, and third, the right of return for Palestinian refugees in accordance with UN Resolution 194. So BDS called for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against the State of Israel in order to end the occupation, apartheid, and to secure the right of return. It has various different facets: academic boycott, cultural boycott, economic, sports, and so on. It targets Israeli institutions due to their long history and presence of complicity in Israel's violations of human rights. So we target the institutions, not the individuals. We target institutional links, not individual human links between people. Unlike in South Africa, by the way, where the boycott was blanket against everyone South African. Now, I'll talk about some BDS campaigns and why this atmosphere that Israel's impunity is reaching its end and accountability before international law is on the rise against Israel. They feel it and we feel it. We've had a lot of successes since 2005 when BDS was launched until now, far beyond our most optimistic expectations, in fact. In 2011, the University of Johannesburg, very important symbolically, was the first to sever links with an Israeli university, Ben-Gurion University, over its complicity in human rights violations. In the cultural boycott, we've had many more successes than any other part of BDS, in fact. In the last 2 years alone, the number of artists who have canceled scheduled performances in Israel or who have refused altogether to play in Israel, to show their films in Israel, to participate in conferences, has mushroomed, has reached an extremely high level where Israel is extremely alarmed. Israel is extremely alarmed about the growth of BDS to the extent, just one example, Israel passed the anti-boycott law, which prevents Israeli citizens and residents from advocating for the boycott. And if you're Israeli and you write an article, say, I think the boycott is a good, moral, nonviolent form of resisting the occupation and apartheid, and the next day a settlement loses X million dollars of revenue due to some boycott in Europe succeeding, they can sue you, according to this law, and you'll have to pay a fine without having to prove, without the judges needing to see a correlation between your advocating for the boycott and the settlement's loss of revenue. It's the most draconian law. It's really Middle Ages type of laws. But as I usually say, it's the first draconian Israeli law that's not racist. It does not discriminate Arab or Jew. As long as you call for boycott, then you're held accountable. Companies that have been colluding with Israel's violations of human rights with total impunity are now feeling the pinch. They're losing revenue because of it. So there's accountability on the rise. I'll just give a few examples. Code Pink, the anti-war movement, predominantly feminist movement, they targeted one specific product, Ahava, which is the cosmetics made of Dead Sea products. Most of its production is done in an illegal colony in the occupied West Bank. So they targeted this one particular brand, one particular company, and it spread across the world. Of course, they were very creative, you know, demonstrating in pink bikinis in big malls. That attracts the Washington Post and CNNs and everyone else. And it spread. In the Netherlands, it was too cold, so they couldn't wear bikinis. They wore bathrobes. But it still attracted the entire Dutch media. And in Australia and everywhere. So BDS does not come in one flavor or one size that fits all. It depends a lot on the context sensitivity principle. So it depends on the creativity and innovation of local activists. One Dutch woman who was a veteran of the anti-apartheid movement, one of the leaders of the anti-apartheid movement in the Netherlands, started a campaign to convince a bank in the Netherlands to stop its operations in Israel that was supporting the settlements. She went to the bank and spoke to the top manager of the bank, presenting all the facts, all the documents, human rights, international law, blah, blah, blah. But he's a banker. You know, ethics is Chinese. Anyway, or Arabic, whatever the context may be. But then he said, OK, I'll consider the documents. She said, great. When can I see you again to see what you've decided after considering what I've presented to you? He said, 3 months, whatever. So she came after 3 months with a bunch of lawyers, community leaders, feminist leaders, LGBT, and the whole alliance of people that wanted to pressure the bank. So they went to the bank manager and they said, you know, the banks are not having their best times, really. There's a lot of competition and we can just pull our money and go to the next bank. You're all the same to us. We want to see action. We want to see an end of your complicity. After 6 months, they divested. They sold off their operation in Israel and this bank stopped investing in the settlement industry. So that was a success by one particular woman. But here in the US as well, I tour the US quite often and I speak on campuses quite often from Princeton's and Yale's and Columbia's to the smallest community colleges. And I'm noticing a trend that's scaring the Israeli establishment and the Israel lobby establishment in this country. The conversion, so to speak, of young Jewish activists away from Zionism towards the human rights perspective. We're seeing that increasingly. Across the United States, we're seeing young Jewish activists joining the BDS movement, joining divestment campaigns, and it's scaring the hell out of those establishment, the ADLs and APACs and so on of the world, who want to speak on behalf of all Jews, who want to monopolize the Jewish voice. So it's not just Israel, it's also Israel's organs in this country who say it's them versus the Jews. It's the Arabs, the Palestinians, the Muslims, the nutty leftists against the Jews, as if they speak for all the Jews. And that this leads them to accuse BDS of anti-Semitism. We're hearing that a lot. Let's try to consider this anti-Semitism accusation. I've said this before and I'll repeat it. Those who say boycotting Israel is anti-Semitic are making an anti-Semitic statement. Let me explain why. Because they're saying that all Jews are one monolithic sum, and Israel speaks on their behalf and represents them. So if you attack Israel, you attack the Jews. All the Jews are the same. Only Nazis and Zionists think all the Jews are the same. Anyone who thinks all Jews are anything is an anti-Semite. They're part of the human species, which means they have diversity. They can't be all the same. Anyone who claims that is an anti-Semite. So the Zionist leaders in this country are making anti-Semitic statements when they say attacking Israeli policy is attacking the Jews. There's also a growth of BDS, not just on campuses, not just among faith groups, also among academics, cultural workers who are increasingly voicing concerns about Israeli policies. Jewish Voice for Peace led an effort whereby tens of leading Hollywood Broadway artists in the US, many of them Jewish, signed a statement supporting an Israeli partial selective boycott against the colonies, against Ariel and against the settlements. Okay, it's a partial boycott, but associating the B word and Israel in one sentence in any context in this country was absolutely taboo not too long ago. Now, Hollywood and Broadway figures are ready to consider a boycott of anything Israeli. That's a huge step forward, and it's popularizing the concept that only through pressure, as in South Africa, as in the civil rights movement, and the bus company, Montgomery Bus Company boycott, you need pressure to bring those companies to accountability and to make states stop oppressing the people that they're oppressing. So I think that the concept of pressure to get to human rights has been vindicated.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to excerpts from a presentation by the Lannan Foundation about the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. Up next, Amy Goodman, co-host of Democracy Now!, speaks with Palestinian human rights activist Omar Barghouti.
How did BDS get started?
BDS is rooted in a long tradition of Palestinian nonviolent popular resistance, because many people think that it's entirely based on the South African anti-apartheid boycott movement. It's very much inspired by the South African as well as the US civil rights movement, but it's not rooted in those. It's rooted in the Palestinian heritage of popular resistance. As far back as the 1920s, we've had boycotts and strikes and demonstrations and women's movements taking action against British products, Zionist products at the time, and so on. So it's very much rooted in the First Intifada. There were famous boycotts of Israeli products and of boycotting the tax in Beit Sahur, for example, near Bethlehem. So it's very much a Palestinian form of resistance. But in 2005, After the Israeli reoccupation, reinvasion of the West Bank 2002 and the massacre in the Jenin refugee camp, many intellectuals and academics and activists reached the conclusion that the international community under U.S. hegemony is unable, unwilling, or both to hold Israel to account. Israel has a free rein to do whatever it wishes to the Palestinian people with the total protection of the U.S. Congress and therefore Europe, the U.S. government, and so on. This led us to believe that we've got to go the path of the South African movement and call for international solidarity. The main concept in BDS in 2005 was that we're asking institutions to end their support for an illegal system, not to come to the garrisons, as it were, and fight with us against the occupation. Just end your support to the occupation, we'll take care of the rest.
One of the more controversial aspects of BDS is the boycott of academic institutions in Israel. Explain.
Yeah, the first attack was that we are blacklisting academics, which is absolutely false. I mean, there's no testing, blacklisting, or any other term being used against academics. It's completely targeting institutions. But still, we were attacked by liberal Zionist groups, mainly, in the U.S., in Israel, and elsewhere, that you're shooting yourself in the foot. Attacking academic institutions that are at the forefront of the struggle against the occupation must be self-defeating. What are you doing? Why start with the academy? And actually, this is based on a lot of myths propagated by those soft Zionists, that Israeli academics somehow stand at the forefront of the battle for Palestinian rights. It's absolutely false. There's no evidence of this on record. I'll just give a couple of examples. Other than the fact that all Israeli academic institutions are deeply, deeply complicit in planning, implementing, justifying, and whitewashing Israel's violations of international law, all polls among Israeli academics do not show any difference from the general public. They're just as right-wing, just as opposed to Palestinian rights. In 2008, four Jewish Israeli academics started a petition asking the authorities in the territories, they did not even call them occupied territories, lest they offend, calling on the Israeli authorities in the territories to allow Palestinian academics and students access to their schools. Basic academic freedom. They sent it to all 9,000 Israeli academics, hoping that every decent academic should sign that. It's not calling for ending the occupation or anything, God forbid. Just allow them access. 407 signed out of 9,000 academics. We don't have any evidence of the Israeli academics standing in their majority for anything, even ending the occupation.
What does it mean, boycott of academic institutions? What does that mean?
It means severing institutional links. So, for example, academics usually do not represent their universities. They are affiliated with their universities. If you're an academic going to present a paper at a conference in Norway, let's say, you're not representing your institution. You're representing yourself. The boycott does not prevent that because we do not target individuals. Once there's representation, so let's say this university in Norway has an exchange program with Hebrew University. That's an institutional link. We target that link to break that link. Now, there's a nuance to it. Thanks to a brave Israeli writer who revealed in Haaretz in 2008, there's a contract that Israeli academics, poets, writers, musicians, dancers have to sign to get Israeli foreign ministry money, an actual contract. And there are two clauses in this contract that say, I shall not undermine the policies of the State of Israel. I shall do my best to serve the policies of the State of Israel. After learning about this contract, we immediately, the boycott campaign, said, anyone who signs this contract is forfeiting any claim to academic or cultural freedom. They're accepting to be ambassadors of the State of Israel, not poets, not writers, not academics. If they accept this money on this condition, to serve the policies of an apartheid colonial state, they should not enjoy academic freedom.
How close do you think Palestinians are coming to having a state, if you're for a two-state solution, or equality for a one-state solution. How would you compare it to where South Africa was along that spectrum? And ultimately, what gives you hope?
That's a tough question. I don't know, really. I don't know the answer to that, because I don't think anyone can predict what Israel might do next. Yes, we can see the intensification of this fanatic right policies in Israel. Massive support for ethnic cleansing, high school kids, university kids. It's not just the older generation. In fact, the younger generation is far worse than the older generation. Is this a cause for hopelessness? That can be the easy way out, the escape. Yes, let's give up hope. Israel is becoming fascist, nothing to be done, and, let's give up. But actually, as we've seen in other cases of such intensive oppression, grave oppression, it takes not just internal resistance and the will to resist, it takes international solidarity, as in boycotts and divestment and sanctions, to bring people to their senses. If I were an Israeli parent, I wouldn't want to think which platoon in the army my daughter is joining after high school. I would want to think where my daughter would go for college, what she wants to do in her life, her career, her options in life, and so on. Any normal family would like to think that way. Most Israelis cannot. It's a garrison mentality, live by the sword, as Sharon used to say. It's a very, very psychotic, abnormal society, like all colonial societies. And I said that before, it's not some genetic disorder in Israelis. It's the typical colonial society mentality. They're not the first to do that. Afrikaners did this in South Africa. The French in Algeria did that. I mean, it's typical of settler colonies to do that. But once the pressure comes in and becomes very effective, you start seeing cracks in that wall of consensus. You start seeing dissent growing. We have the boycott from within group in Israel, supporting the BDS movement. It's a predominantly Jewish Israeli group. The Coalition of Women for Peace. They're small groups, but they're very effective. And Israel knows they're effective. That's why they passed the anti-boycott law. So that gives us hope that with pressure, with internal resistance, with principled solidarity of progressive Israelis, we can turn the tide. And the tide is indeed turning.
Omar Barghouti, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Omar Barghouti speaking in February 2013 at a presentation by the Lannan Foundation. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. For unedited audio and video of Barghouti's full presentation, go to our website, radioproject.org. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. At Making Contact, we're always looking to hear from listeners like you. Susan Gleason from Oregon did just that.
I'm Susan Gleason, and I love Making Contact. I value the in-depth coverage that Making Contact offers. It's not just the information that's so critical. What I really value about Making Contact are the relationships that the program has with changemakers all over the country.
You can leave your own comments on our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer and Jen Chen producers, Irene Flores web editor, Lisa Bartfai, Salima Hamarani and Aaron Mathewson production interns, and Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner and Alton Bird volunteers. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.